This is Fully Vested, a weekly podcast where Jason Rowley and Graham Peck discuss technology and venture capital investing. This week, after yet another update about WeWork and discussing SoftBank's overall strategy struggles with other portfolio companies, we explore Mark Zuckerberg's congressional testimony about Libra and how better design can be achieved while considering people with visual disabilities when designing technology, especially as it relates to Domino's lack of compliance with ADA standards for online ordering of pizza through their app or website. The show was recorded on October 27th. You can learn more at fullyvested.co.
All right, we're live. So, Graham, I'm talking to you from halfway inside a closet.
Oh,
now,
well, shouldn't you be either all in or all out?
Well, so we're staying at. So I'm not in Chicago at the moment. I'm traveling, and we're in this apartment. And it's one of those apartments that, you know how like a lot of places are doing, they're just fully furnished apartments. So you can like rent out for a few nights as if it was a hotel, but it doesn't necessarily have all the amenities of a hotel. Are you familiar with this concept?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So absolutely everything in this entire place is very smooth. And there's no soft surfaces, which means that everything echoes.
Oh, everything echoes.
Everything, yes, everything echoes. And so what I've done is a trick that I've heard radio producers do, which is you set up your closet as if it was a recording booth. And so what you can't see in front of me is that I have my comforter from my bed hoisted up in the closet by way of the little clippy, you know, like the little pants clips on a 6 different clothes hangers to try to reduce echo. Graham, what I'm saying is I sacrifice a lot for good audio.
Ah. Oh, I'm getting some maybe some internet delays here.
Oh no. I'm going to kill my video.
Let's see. It could be me.
Could be you. I want to blur my background. Ooh. Okay. Let me actually turn off my video. Okay. So yeah, that's a fun thing happening in my life right now.
Yeah, so you've built your own little mini recording studio right there in a closet.
Yes, I have. I have. So Graham, you've done a little bit of travel recently.
Yeah, I've also done some travel. It was a lot of fun. I visited Minneapolis, St. Paul, the Twin Cities area, for the first time on Wednesday of this week through Friday.
What were you doing up there?
I just had kind of a variety of different meetings on behalf of cultivation, as well as a couple of other projects that I'm working on. So just kind of had 3 or 4 different meetings for 3 or 4 different reasons that I wanted to take in. Had never been to the area, wanted to go visit it before it got too wintry there.
Mm. Too late. It's very cold up there.
It's very cold up there. It was shocking to me how cold it was, still on October, 23rd through 25th.
And it's only
I did not
six
see any
drive,
snow, but.
Well, and it's only a 6-hour drive north from Chicago. 5 or 6, what is it? 5 or 6 hours if you're driving?
Yeah. Yeah. About six. I flew there.
Tell me about your flight.
And then on my it was this flight there was excellent, wonderful. We arrived quite early, very nice, 1 hour in the air. My flight back was quite an experience. After an incredibly smooth takeoff, along, and I was headed back actually to St. Louis to meet my sister there where she lives for the weekend, and uh turbulence and preparing to kind of take evasive action. And holy cow, that was quite an experience. I ended up picking my drink up off of the tray table and while holding it for additional balance, proceeded to spill it all over the window of the plane.
Nice.
My cell phone, my iPad on which I was watching TV at the time, my pants, and in my shoe.
In your shoe.
So yeah, it was a great experience. Ended up with a juicy shoe.
Juicy shoe.
My sock was wet for the rest of the day.
Nice.
But yeah, was a great experience. We still made it to the gate in St. Louis 2 minutes early. Pilots did a wonderful job. I think there was absolutely no real danger, but it was certainly not an enjoyable experience. Not one I had ever had on a plane before. I guess I've had a lot of up and down turbulence in my life in so many ways, but I meant literally while on planes. And this was like a weird kind of, it felt like lateral turbulence that was pushing us from side to side. So anyway,
that's wild.
Overall, it was a great trip. Really enjoy the Twin Cities area and look forward to going back there again soon.
Okay. Well, so Graham, this is the show, I guess. I know this is the show. What are we doing here, Graham? Or rather, you know, that gets covered in the intro, but I guess we should say who we are and nominally what we're going to be talking about today. Do you want to kick off?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So for our listeners out there, this of course is Fully Vested. I am Graham Peck, one of your co-hosts. I am a venture partner at Cultivation Capital, which is a Midwestern-based seed and Series A stage venture fund, investing in life sciences, ag sciences, and specifically the fund I work with is our technology fund that invests in IT and other software-based businesses. Today, we've got some, I think, really interesting topics. I'll just go over real quick.
Before you do it, I got to tell everybody who I am. Don't steal the thunder, Graham.
All right. I won't steal the thunder.
Yeah. All right, everybody.
Oh, and I guess I didn't even finish my intro. So, geez, I interrupted myself, really, not even you, Jason. I help companies large and small, startups and otherwise, build their technology teams using some really phenomenal staff aug and kind of recruiting partners, especially the folks at Brightgrove in Eastern Europe. Sorry, I interrupted myself, my own intro with topics. Wow. We shouldn't record so early in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah. Graham, have you had your coffee yet?
I'm just starting.
Oh,
just
God. Starting. Oh, this is going to be the world's...
Oh, yeah. Could be bumpy.
Oh, this could be a real barn burner of an episode, guys. Okay. Oh, boy. Where to start? Okay, so hey, everybody. My name is Jason Rowley. I am a data journalist for Crunchbase News, where I munch and crunch all of Crunchbase data to answer interesting questions and make charts and graphs for both myself and the rest of the Crunchbase News team. And when I'm not doing that, I also do some volunteer work for the Python Software Foundation, helping them reach out to early stage startups that use Python in interesting ways, and giving those startups free booth space at PyCon US, which in 2020 is happening in the lovely city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And then, I kind of share a little bit of everything that I do in a occasional newsletter called the Rowley Report, and you can subscribe to the Rowley Report at Rowley, my last name, .report. Graham, we have a real slate of topics to talk about today,
I'm excited. I'm excited. There's good stuff going on.
I am too.
That's why I was so excited to jump on to topics earlier. So
it's like caffeine by proxy.
I think, It is. I think the things that we're going to talk about, and Jason, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we're going to talk about an ongoing update at WeWork, which is kind of the gift that seems to keep on giving in the technology and venture capital world. And it's really interesting. Actually, the most recent article I read was more about Sprint than about WeWork, but about SoftBank and some of the challenges that they've got. And that's kind of an update on two different fronts that we've typically covered here. So an update on SoftBank and its ongoing machinations with WeWork and Sprint, I think, in this case. We're also going to talk about Mark Zuckerberg and his testimony in front of Congress earlier this week about Libra. And then we're doing something that I think is really cool and something that's in a lot of ways near and dear to the cultivation team's heart. And that is we're going to talk about kind of ADA and how technology companies do or how they sometimes fail at making their technology accessible to people with various disabilities, in particular, probably people who are blind or have other visual disabilities, which again, I think is really interesting. We have a portfolio company called Be My Eyes, which is all about helping companies make their technology more accessible to people with various different visual disabilities. So again, something that we're super excited about at Cultivation. So, nice. Jason, which of those should we dive into first? Well, updates first, maybe?
Well, yeah, let's do some follow up. So, Graham, you and I, we've chatted ad nauseum at this point about WeWork stuff, and although this
is probably right,
yeah. Well, and although this is probably not the the last time that we will talk about WeWork, I sincerely hope that this is the last time in a little while that we will talk about WeWork, because quite frankly, I. As fun as it is to follow what is happening there, I'm also getting kind of tired of it because there's always something new, and I just kind of constantly find myself wondering how did things get this bad, and to that end, we learned, and that's we referring to the general public rather than we. The company, although I suppose that both grammatical constructions would work, we found out that it is not worth what it thought it was worth, and SoftBank ended up basically taking over the surpassing majority of the company. So, Graham, do you want to go down the rabbit hole and discuss some of those financial details?
Yeah, sure. So, SoftBank, of course, has already made substantial investment, in WeWork, now is preparing or maybe has now executed, but has executed on a $5 billion deal that I think puts it in dramatic control.
Call it a bailout.
Okay, a $5 billion bailout. That's probably accurate. To buy 80% of the company. And I believe they've also reserved something like $3 billion for additional secondary buyouts. So, again, I think all of that together probably puts about $8 billion buying about 80% of the company from a combination of new capital going in for future growth as well as secondary buyouts. But again, that puts the whole company's valuation probably, right in the $10 billion at max. Range, obviously, way down from the $47 billion post money valuation of the last round that SoftBank not only participated in but also led. And if I'm not mistaken, I think an article I read, not something I'm looking at right now, but said that SoftBank alone, you know, at the close of this, as well as potentially a couple of other separate but side and related deals that they've already committed to with Adam Neumann and maybe other parties in some cases, will put their total investment in WeWork at $18.5 billion. So they're going to be, the whole company's value will be underwater by give or take 50% just on what SoftBank has invested to date.
Which is truly astonishing, especially considering that so much of this money came from the SoftBank Vision Fund. And, you know, the SoftBank Vision Fund is a $100 billion fund, which is obviously a lot of money. To overweight so much of a portfolio in one company is an interesting financial move on SoftBank's part, and we've seen just how well this has all worked out for them. Some other highlights from this: Adam Neumann was given a non-trivial amount of money to leave. I think he ended up walking away in total with something on the order of $1.7 billion in compensation and basically I think it was a one-time payout of $200 million to step away from the board entirely. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's right.
You know, Graham,
and
this
that,
is
and
a,
that of course doesn't include that doesn't include the $700 million I don't believe that he took in a prior secondary sale. So
no. So Graham, wow. This is a
lot of money.
Well, you know, this should be an inspiration to founders everywhere that you know, instead of going out and trying to build a you know, a sustainable business with a repeatable you know, revenue model, that all you got to do is you got to go start a co-working company, and you got to say that it's elevating human consciousness. And then you go talk to Masayoshi Son, and you raise something on the order of $18 billion from that one investor alone. And you walk away with about, you as the founder walk away with about 10% of the gross investment. And, then you call it a day, and then you have generational wealth for the next century. It's a pretty good deal, man.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a pretty scary thing. As a venture investor, it's definitely a scary precedent to you know, to set with a portfolio company. You know, because obviously when we're investing in companies, we want our founder and founding teams and their employees to be aligned with us. And boy, it doesn't seem like there's any way that's the case here. But
no,
boy, I guess it's a good deal if you can get it.
Yep. So yeah, there isn't really. You know, yeah, go on.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I guess one of the other things again, and we'll include the link to the article read on CNBC about Sprint as well. But, you know, I mean, I guess, and we talked briefly about this in a prior episode too, but I guess part of my question is if in any way this is kind of a symptom of a bigger problem at SoftBank, you know, because Sprint, which they came in and bought initially around 72% of a few years ago, and upped that buyout to around or maybe slightly north of 80, right around the same terms or percentage as they'll own of WeWork, has not done well. You know, and we've talked about executive team exits at several SoftBank-backed companies separately in the past. And I think that there was a major turbulence at Fair, which is another participant in the ride sharing community, and a SoftBank backed company this week. And again, as SoftBank is out raising Vision Fund number two, again, if I was a potential LP in this, I would have just a whole bunch of questions about what the long term viability of their strategy is.
Well, to that, okay. So first off, let's put a very quick pin in the strategy side for one second. and just start by saying that really the past couple of weeks has been, the real theme around SoftBank has been, not only does it invest a lot of money, but the companies that it has invested a lot of money in are also now laying a lot of people off. So to your earlier point about FAIR, the company, so I'm reading now or paraphrasing from a TechCrunch article that I believe broke the news of layoffs at that company, which is, so FAIR, it's worth or valued at approximately $1.2 billion. SoftBank has invested $500 million in equity, and there's plenty more that FAIR has secured in various debt facilities. And it stated earlier this week that it will be laying off approximately 40% of its staff. And in addition to this, it is removing its CFO, who is also, and this draws all sorts of questions about conflict of interest. CFO was the brother of the CEO and co-founder, and he's being replaced by somebody else. The one thing to note is it's not really clear how many employees are at FAIR, at least according to this TechCrunch article. It seems like there's north of 500 employees that say that they work there on LinkedIn. But, that's a big deal. And similarly, WeWork will be laying off many thousands of employees as well as part of a broader restructuring of the company. And so... I know that Graham, you and I have talked in the past about, this model of like super giant, venture capital funding and how, investors might see an opportunity to invest, hundreds of millions of dollars in a relatively late stage company and secure the type of stake on a percentage basis that might be afforded to, say, a Series A or Series B investor, but they do it at much later stage, presuming that they will have lower risk because these companies are ostensibly more mature. However, it seems like it's incredibly difficult to figure out how to effectively spend all this money that SoftBank and investors like it are seemingly so keen to invest in these later stage startups, and I think that this is a thing that founders and their executive teams are still really, really grappling with. And so Graham, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that before we chat very briefly about strategy challenges at the Vision Fund.
No, nothing else separate on that. But yeah, I mean, it obviously is just the most recent in a long list of SoftBank companies that that have some substantial challenges. Going back for just one second to SoftBank of $100 billion fund putting $18.5 billion into one portfolio company. I don't know if they have limits on how much they can invest in one company, but traditional venture funds often have a limit, and this is no comment about ours specifically, but traditional venture funds also have a limit on the percentage of any one fund vehicle that can be invested into a single portfolio company. And the pure reason for that, for LP friendliness or investor friendliness really in those funds, is because most investors are investing to get a diversified bite of a whole bunch of companies. And obviously that's one of the core pieces of the strategy and thesis of a given venture fund. But if SoftBank made four or so investments the size of WeWork, that would likely before they spend their management fees, again, if their management fees are a typical 2-20 kind of structure, that would likely spend the entire fund. Now, obviously, they're making a lot of smaller investments like the one you just mentioned in FAIR, which, again, would be quite large for most other venture funds, but at only $500 million, for a $100 billion fund is much smaller. But I guess I also wonder from a governance perspective inside SoftBank what they're thinking and if they're approaching what, again, would probably be a typical 15 to 20% of the fund at max going into any one portfolio company. I'm sure that they could create sidecars or SPVs or other type of structures to increase that if they've got additional capital or access to it to put in alongside them or help be a piece of that bailout structure now going on at WeWork. But again, that would be another one of my questions for them is kind of what's the future vision here, guys?
Well, not to make any puns about the Vision Fund.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, well, so...
Didn't even realize they did that.
So there's a couple of things to note. One is I'm going, in our show notes, I will include a link to a fantastic article from the Financial Times published in 2017 that explains actually does a pretty good job of explaining the fee structure that that the Vision Fund employs. It's more along the lines of a really big PE fund, you know, as opposed to the very the relatively simple 2 and 20 fee structure common in venture and some hedge funds. But where was I? Oh, yeah. So back to the sort of strategy, what I'll refer to as like strategy debt. It seems like SoftBank and its Vision Fund are in the middle of reassessing what exactly it is and what they want to do. And I've taken enormous joy, Graham, in seeing on Twitter, these job listings show up, for working at SoftBank Investment Advisors. So recently they're hiring a valuations expert in their New York office or their head of valuations in New York. They are hiring a head of corporate governance, all sorts of these things that you would have thought would have been put in place long, long before. It seems like they're either hiring fresh or there's been some turnover in those roles. So, yeah, I think that this is certainly not the last we've heard of the shenanigans going on with Vision Fund companies. And the one thing that I also just wanted to note is, so SoftBank has a very interesting relationship with its Vision Fund, which is that SoftBank has been, and Masayoshi-san personally, has been a very active investor in technology companies for a long time. And the only reason I'm bringing this up in this case is I don't know what percentage of the, what did you say it was, like $18 billion plus or minus?
Yeah, if all of the pieces of all of the different deals and side deals end up closing, I think it's going to be in total, and this is, CNBC's reporting, not my own, and we'll include a note or a link in the show notes, but will be about $18.5 billion in total into WeWork.
All right. So, but the thing that's important to note is that I do not know what the breakdown of SoftBank versus SoftBank Vision Fund money is into that. I'll give a real quick example. SoftBank purchased a non-trivial chunk of NVIDIA. I think it was, I don't have the numbers exactly in front of me, but I think it was something around somewhere between like 5 and 8%. I know it was under 10%, but so SoftBank invested billions of dollars into NVIDIA, which is one of the leading manufacturers of high performance graphics cards is probably the world that most consumers will recognize them from. But they do a bunch of stuff with more specialized like AI machine learning chips as well. But that was an investment by SoftBank that was later transferred into the Vision Fund's portfolio. And this has been a pattern that has repeated itself over time, not just with NVIDIA, but I know that when SoftBank bought ARM, the chip company, that was also a SoftBank-led transaction that was later the equity of which was also later transferred into the Vision Fund's portfolio. So there's I'm not saying that there's anything squirrely or like not above board with that sort of a strategy, but it is an important thing to keep in mind when discussing SoftBank versus its Vision Fund's investments in various assets. So I just wanted to get that one little bit out of the way. Graham, is there?
Yeah. And that's interesting and probably causes tons of potential conflicts of interest. Because do they sell the best investments that SoftBank makes outside of the Vision Fund to the Vision Fund? Do they keep the best investments that they make for themselves? Or maybe asked a different way and seemingly more appropriately, what do they do with their worst investments?
Oh, right.
Which seem to be a growing number of. And to the earlier article that I referenced, they are currently underwater on Sprint, and are all but begging the FCC and other regulatory bodies to approve the sale of Sprint to T-Mobile, which I believe the terms of which would exit them at $6.62 per share. And when they acquired the majority stake, which again has increased over time to somewhere north of 80%, they acquired it for $7.65 per share. So they're losing, a little over a dollar per share, which is, again, probably a scary precedent to set.
Graham, real-time fact check. SoftBank made a profit on their NVIDIA transaction. So they purchased the NVIDIA shares at an average of $105, and they liquidated the shares at $218 a share. So they returned. They derived.
Oh wow! That's a pretty substantial increase.
Yeah, but again, it's the challenge of determining. To your earlier point about conflicts of interest and stuff. It's unclear what their policies or what their strategy is there. So Mark Zuckerberg was on Capitol Hill this week discussing the project that Facebook has spearheaded called Libra, and that is there's some questions about how exactly to refer to it. Mark Zuckerberg was very insistent on referring to it as a payment system, which is backed by a cryptocurrency transacted on a permissioned blockchain called Libra. Facebook has a subsidiary. So Facebook itself is part of the Libra Association, and is a parent to a subsidiary entity called Calibra, which is developing independently developing, but still sort of under the aegis of Facebook, a wallet system for Libra. Basically the goal for Facebook is to create a payment system that people can use to send money around the world for really low fees and to do so incredibly quickly. which is all seems pretty admirable on its face. But various regulators had a number of questions pertaining directly to Libra. And then, as is always the case with Mark Zuckerberg testimony on Capitol Hill, there's also a tremendous scope creep to include a bunch of other seemingly unrelated subjects related to regulation of political speech and, you know, continuing to rake them over the coals for Facebook's role in various misinformation, or role as a medium for spreading misinformation and disinformation. Facebook itself is not a publisher of stuff. It tries to be, to the best of its ability, a neutral platform for this sort of stuff. But yeah, so anyway, so Mark Zuckerberg was chatting about Libra, and Graham, I thought that this might be a fun thing for you and I to unpack a little bit. Did you watch any of the testimony, or what have you read about it? If you haven't watched it,
yeah. Yeah, so I've watched only a few brief highlights, but it seems like most of the things that I read, you know, as follow-ups were broadly that people were relatively disappointed and feel that they called Zuck to speak because they didn't have enough information from Facebook's former head of or from the speech prior. From Facebook's head of cryptocurrency, you know, generally, I think Congress was underwhelmed and feels that overall they probably didn't get any additional or new information from Mark Zuckerberg during his testimony. Again, a lot of his answers seem to really make a finer point about the differentiation between Facebook and Libra. I think there was a lot of questions about regulation of Libra and why Libra needed to exist going forward. And again, I think it feels like people weren't satisfied that they had gotten clarity on why it should exist and kind of how it should exist, or didn't get the commitment they wanted or expected that Facebook and the other members of the Libra Association would wait until appropriate regulatory frameworks were set up before they would commence with Libra, you know, basically
out.
Moving forward.
Yeah. So now, to be fair, there's been so Mark Zuckerberg did elucidate some of these points. He explained that. That Facebook would pull out of the Libra Association if the development of Libra, or the rollout of Libra rather, occurred without the full sort of blessing of primarily U.S. regulators, because obviously Facebook is a U.S.-based entity, even though the Libra Association is based in Switzerland, which itself was a major bone of contention with U.S. Congress people. There was some discussion about whether China was working on a similar cryptocurrency type system or blockchain based payment system that would be primarily anchored to the yuan. Actually, Graham, I do have a little bit of information on this, which is a long while ago. I met up with an individual who is Chinese, and they did indicate that there is an internal project that is aimed at rolling out an RMB or yuan based cryptocurrency ostensibly sponsored by the Chinese government, which as Graham, you and I have sort of touched on, but have certainly observed in recent developments in U.S. The sports and entertainment scene, that China has a growing influence internationally. Let's see what else he's talked about. Yeah, there's a bunch of other stuff about privacy, and this is actually a thing that I wanted to delve into. So I started writing something, but I never published it. And so if you can, if you'll indulge me, Graham, and everybody else who's listening, I do have a quick note to share.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. quoting myself, distractions aside, the Libra-related questions fell into several themes. Privacy was one of them. Recall that more than a decade ago, Facebook launched a service called Beacon, which let companies share information about customers' online purchases to their Facebook profiles. That program was announced in October 6, 2007, but took until December 5th for Facebook to allow its users to opt out of Beacon. Although Beacon was shut down in September 2009 and Zuckerberg later called the initiative, quote, a mistake, unquote, it's worth asking one of the world's largest consumer data aggregators what it plans to do with something as sensitive as personal financial transaction data. Zuckerberg said that Facebook itself will not collect that data from, you know, related to Libra, but a Facebook subsidiary, Calibra, will. Users of Calibra's Libra cryptocurrency wallet may be able to opt in to sharing that transaction information with Facebook in the future, Zuckerberg said. So the reason I bring this up is you know, there's this talk about, you know, Libra is going to be a private, or that there will be some expectation of. If not privacy, then at least having a wall, legally speaking, between Facebook and Calibra and the Libra Association, that walls off consumer transactions or consumer transaction data into its own sort of silo. Given Facebook's past with sharing and being perhaps a little overly transparent with users' financial information, in other words, I'm saying that the questions that regulators had were probably entirely merited. On the privacy side,
I thought one of the other, and that makes a bunch of sense, and it's super important. As we move forward, I think that people pay attention to privacy related laws, and this is just the most recent in a growing set of obviously privacy concerns, especially around private data related to probably healthcare and finances. Probably the two most heavily regulated industries from cyber compliance standards in the U.S. And I think that, there's no shortness of breaches that are happening in both of those spaces on a daily basis. One of the other things that I found interesting from what I was reading about it was that Mark Zuckerberg and the Libra Association seem to believe that there's a substantial percentage of people in the U.S. who are unbanked, and that Libra or things like Libra, cryptocurrencies more broadly, can help those folks who are unbanked for any number of reasons. Although I'd guess one of the biggest maybe being their status of citizenship in the U.S., but to have access to nominally the features that anyone else who has traditional banking available to them has here in the U.S. And I think I've seen some numbers on that, although I can't seem to find the number right now, but it was a substantial number of several million people who can't for some number of reasons, again, likely documentation of their citizenship status being the biggest reason, can't get access to traditional banks out there and Libra, he sees, or the Libra Association sees, as an advantage for the folks who find themselves in that population as well.
Yeah, and by the way, I do think that Mark Zuckerberg did bring up a couple of good points regarding at least his assessment that the U.S. Financial system is wanting for some innovation. You know, obviously there's been billions and billions of dollars invested into financial technology startups, which are all attempting to sort of build upon the sort of legacy financial system that we have today. And no doubt, you know, we can look at a number of like big successes, you know, Plaid, Stripe, Square. There's plenty of others. But you know, having a Facebook's sort of big accomplishment as a company was to take all of this data that has been, you know, that was previously not quantified, right? So all the, you know, interpersonal connections, all of the sort of expressions of preferences, right? So all the people who like said, oh, I like this band's page or whatever. Like all those things have now sort of been collated into one, and they built a programmable interface against that data to allow advertisers primarily to advertise stuff in a much more targeted fashion. In a similar way, you know, it would be interesting. It's interesting that now there's this talk of basically building API infrastructure around money itself is nominally under the umbrella of Facebook. But yeah, I don't know. It just seems it seems kind of interesting. And then also to that earlier point that I just made, and this is about the long-term viability of Libra itself. Most of the payments partners that were previously part of the Libra Association backed out of the association prior to its very first meeting. And if, like I said, most of those partners were in the payment space. So Visa said that they never actually formally had an agreement to join, that there was a, you know, letter of intent or something to that effect. But you know, MasterCard pulled out, PayPal pulled out, eBay pulled out. I think Stripe pulled out as well. There's a whole slew of them that are no longer part of the Libra Association. And so I'm kind of curious to know what its viability is going forward without the very payment partners that would have served as a gateway into Libra going forward. So that's also one of those, you know, remains to be seen sorts of things.
Yeah, you know, and one of the other things going back to, I think the last thing I was talking about, I've seen what seems like an increasing number of ads around the internet for various digital only banks. And I wonder how those, I wonder what their view of Libra is, and I wonder if they have, you know, any kind of view of helping the unbanked population, you know, as well. Obviously, I think that there's probably a growing divide economically, you know, in the country right now, and not to get into bigger political topics, but one of the things that I've seen at least Chime and maybe a couple of others advertise is that you'll receive your cash for your paycheck up to 2 days earlier than not using that. I don't know how they're facilitating that in the background, but you know, that's interesting, you know, as well when you look at payment processing technology. You know, obviously one of the big complaints, I think, with traditional banking. Certainly one of my complaints is the speed at which it moves, which seems to be near glacial pace compared to the speed of a lot of other things in today's world. Again, maybe something the Libra Association can address over time.
Yeah. Just as a very, very, very minor example of that, I've always found it really fun that that if I wanted to pay, for example, a credit card bill, so I bank with Chase, not a sponsor, whatever, just saying. So I bank with Chase, and I find it really funny that as soon as I have to pay a credit card bill, the money is immediately taken out of my checking account, you know, as soon as I initiate that payment. But if I want to move money from, say, you know, a savings account that I have with the brokerage that I use or wherever else, you know, that's all of a sudden like, oh, you know, absolutely no way this will take any faster than like 3 days to move the money. And I'm like, oh my God, somewhere along the line, that's part of the banking system that I would be genuinely curious to learn a lot more about is that interchange process and why the hell it takes so gosh darn long. But yeah, anyways, I don't know. I don't know if Libra will launch or what sort of larger impact it will have when it does. I think that to some earlier points that we've made about cryptocurrencies in general, I remain a believer in many of the ideals that were behind, you know, the very first cryptocurrency, Bitcoin. And I still see it having, still see cryptocurrency, not necessarily Bitcoin, not necessarily any individual cryptocurrency, having a tremendous global impact, specifically for these folks who are unbanked or whatever. The people who are unbanked, people who don't have access to the legacy financial system, etc. But that being said, I also am wondering whether or not the impact that cryptocurrency type technology promises might be best reached through a more centralized organization, like, for example, the Libra Association, backed primarily by Facebook, which, Graham, is not something that I would have said 5 years ago, because that would have just been sort of antithetical to my politics and beliefs back then. But I'm not necessarily a big cheerleader of Facebook, you know, here in this case. But if as a company it's able to spearhead the adoption of a new, you know, type of money, or at least a payment system that facilitates low or no fee transactions around the world at, pretty instantaneous speed, and then has a nice programmable layer on top of it. Like, I in general think that's a pretty good thing, even if it is, you know, tied to, a company that, many people rightfully have a fair amount of skepticism about. So, yeah, I don't know. It's going to be weird. Do you want to talk about accessibility, or was there something else that you wanted to chat about the Facebook Libra thing?
Talk about what? I'm sorry?
Accessibility, like the ADA and, how software developers and designers can make things more accessible to folks, for example, with blindness or other visual impairments.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Sorry, you were breaking up there for just one second.
Oh, no, I'm so sorry. Blame the internet.
You know, Yeah, the medium on which we record and host our podcast is failing us in so many ways right now.
Oh my God.
So, you know, one of the interesting things that that's come out and that Jason suggested we talk about this week, and I thought was a really good idea because it's something I'm both personally passionate about, and also you know, our firm Cultivation has invested, you know, in a related space, is that Domino's has gotten in some trouble because a gentleman had some difficulty ordering. He was blind or had some other visual impairment, and he could not order a pizza with their app or their website. And so he sued them, stating that just as a pizza store is considered a public place and has to comply with ADA requirements about, you know, doors being accessible to people in who are wheelchair bound, other things like that. And, you know, cited the kind of public use clause. He said that the website should similarly, the website and or app should similarly have to follow the same structure and allow for him, a blind individual, to order. And there is a lot of great technology out there, and it's not that it's even complex or that expensive for a company like Domino's today to comply with. And so the Supreme Court said that they will not hear this, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I guess, depending upon your point of view. But yeah, it's an interesting case to look at where there's a relatively low barrier of entry of technology becoming a lot more accessible to a substantial population of users. You know, some information that I've gotten, you know, kind of behind the scenes from our participation in Be My Eyes is that in the U.S. there's about 3.4 million people with you know, various visual disabilities who are either fully blind or have difficulty using standard technology that's out there, and worldwide that number is about 15 million. And both of those, especially with aging populations, are actually expected to increase substantially. So, you know, that's, you know, over 1% of the entire U.S. population. So it's not a not an insignificant number, and it I think it smart for companies to start taking notice of this very, you know, active community. And the really good news for businesses, I think, is that if they go as far as they can to try to help their technology be accessible to people in the blind and sight impaired community, that community will really rally behind them. So yeah, I guess those are some initial thoughts and observations, you know, on what's going on here. And I guess I'm a little bit disappointed that Domino's wouldn't take their technology more seriously, because for a big company like that, the cost of making their stuff more usable for people in the blind or sight impaired community is probably negligible.
Yeah, and so I think that there's a couple of different things that this highlights, and one is that I think that there just needs to be a general shift in mindset in the broader technology business, away from. So, for example, my mom is a physical therapist. She works with kids that have various you know, developmental and physical disabilities. I don't believe she works directly with a lot of blind children, but don't quote me on that. And there's all these like really amazing technologies that make that make the world that, you know, Graham, you and I have the privilege of interfacing without many external aids, except for me, I wear glasses. You know, so like there's all these really great technologies, you know, ranging from screen readers, ranging from, you know, there's all these, there's a few different technologies I've seen that, can translate, websites into, Braille, that, you know, somebody who wants to read what's on a website, you know, without using a screen reader, can sort of feel along as they're reading, or have that get sort of translated into something that they can touch, to sort of read through, you know, read through their fingers, et cetera, et cetera. Like, there's all this stuff that's like really, really cool, but the usability of that gets sacrificed by, by like aesthetics, you know. So the people who want to make things look really nice to people who can see, you know, result in making something that's difficult to use for people who either can't see at all or can't see as, as well as, the quote unquote average person, which itself is kind of a weird construct because nobody is really average. Everybody has their own weird, things, that are up with their bodies or minds or whatever. And then secondarily,
As a matter of full disclosure, I also wear glasses, so I have that visual aid myself. One of the things that I found interesting in the article, which we'll of course include links to in the show notes, is that it's estimated that it would cost Domino's about $38,000 to make their app, work for the people who have these visual impairments. And that seems like a relatively de minimis amount of money. I would guess that 1% of the pizza they sell, which is the community that they would be able to have access to, if they spent $38,000, 1% of pizza sales for Domino's has to far exceed $38,000. So it seems like there's a pretty solid ROI case there, regardless of kind of the humanistic or emotional side of that being just kind of the right thing to do.
Right. And then the other thing that I wanted to bring up is that accessibility helps absolutely everybody. So, for example, I have full use of my hands I'm a little clumsy, but, I whatever lack of dexterity I have is not, in the realm of what might be considered a disability per se, but I buy and use like all the little, like, not a sponsor, but like all the OXO like Good Grips stuff. So like I have a can opener that's sort of like big and chunky, and it's just easier and more pleasant to use for somebody like me, who is otherwise, perfectly able, to use any type of can opener that I want, but I use the one that feels better in my hands and has, that allows me to feel like I have more control over the task at hand. And like that goes way beyond just like, can openers and other little kitchen gadgets. Like, if you have a website that's more readable screen readers, and so just in case somebody is not familiar, a screen reader, it's a piece of software that will take what is written in text and then translate that into speech, and oftentimes it's played back at a very high rate of speed. It's really interesting. Definitely go Google screen readers and listen to how folks who might not be able to see can still read what's on the internet. But like a website that's designed to be accessible to screen readers is also a website that's just easier for people who can read, or not who can read, but people who can see just fine to use. And so like, as we all get older, I know that at some point, my eyes will start to go, or my hands will start to get stiffer or whatever. There's all sorts of different things that'll naturally come up with people as they age. Like, making stuff accessible from the start will ensure some amount of, you know, future proofing to, you know, to not just your technology, but also to various parts of your brand, you know, because you don't want to be seen as the pizza place that won't help a blind person get a pizza through an app.
Right. You know, and again, like the corollary would be, would Domino not change their doorways to allow people in wheelchairs into their establishments? I mean, that sounds absolutely ludicrous. And I don't know what percentage of the population is wheelchair bound. It might be a higher percentage of the population that is blind or has other visual impairments. But, you know, again, that's kind of the thing here. And changing every door in every Domino's would cost way more than $38,000. I think to your point a minute ago, it's interesting to think about, is there a way where it's not either or, and where actually the best design, and this is the case in a lot of cases, I closely with a company that has a large technology accessibility practice. And what they find is that when they're advising somebody on how to make their technology more accessible, they are often advising on the best practices of design that are out there. And one of the interesting things is oftentimes, even for people who have full use of sight and don't have any color blindness or anything else like that, the websites that they end up redesigning through a lens of usability for people with various different visual disabilities, including full blindness, color blindness, and other things of that nature, age-related macular degeneration, other things like that that need reader technology or other assistive things behind them, often end up being better websites, better apps, better interfaces for those people who have full sight, full color spectrum, all of that. And so one of the things that I would encourage Domino's and really, you know, all companies out there to think about is, if you're using best practices, you know, for people who have these disabilities, you're probably improving your product for people who don't have these disabilities. And that, I think, is something that's really important. And again, shout out to Be My Eyes. They're doing great things to support the blind and visually impaired community. And again, those numbers today are 1% of the U.S. population, but that number is going to grow dramatically, you know, as the baby boomers continue to age. And there are some interesting statistics that I can't quote chapter and verse on that.
For sure. So I also wanted to give a shout out to a really great podcast called Accessible. It is hosted by Steve Aquino and Timothy Buck. And the entire subject of the podcast is about accessibility in technology. Primarily, it has a lot of coverage of Apple specific stuff, but it's about accessibility in tech more generally, and it is a very interesting and enlightening listen for anybody who is interested in learning more about the subject.
Grant. Yeah, because Apple does a great job, of course, including screen readers in all of their products natively. I mean, that's just part of the operating system, which obviously is wonderfully compatible with all of this stuff if the people who design the technology make it work for them. You know, one of the other things you mentioned Braille earlier. One of the other notes that I've got is that a shockingly small percentage of blind people today can actually read Braille with any real fluency. So using screen reading or other technology that makes it more accessible to the vast majority of the blind population, I think is really important. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. But yeah, I think it's something like about 9% only can read Braille. 9% of people who are blind or have, you know, other similar visual disabilities. Huh. One of the companies that I had met with previously in Chicago actually talked about making a haptic alphabet where they could feed information to in a similar format to Braille, but with haptic or vibrating type of feedback coming from a device. So just another option in addition to screen reading. And again, something that I think is, fabulous if they're able to give that feedback to people with those disabilities.
For sure. Graham, do you want to wrap this up?
Yeah, sounds great.
All right, man.
It's been fun exploring Libra and talking about accessibility of technology today.
Indeed. And the WeWork / SoftBank saga continues. We will continue to follow those stories and continue chatting about them here on Fully Vested. Graham, anything else?
I think that's it. Is this no longer the show?
This is no longer the show as I press stop on call recording.